Welcome to another Friday. Let me say, first of all, thank you, those of you that have been supporting Into the Word financially. We could not stay on this radio station without that assistance. If there's anyone out there would like to join in that process as well, just write down the contact information you'll hear at the end of today's program. Then you can send your one-time ongoing gift of any amount to that address, and it will be used to keep this thing going. Fridays, I also set aside this time to say, get to church this Lord's Day. Get to church this weekend. You need a home congregation. You need to fellowship and pray and study and encourage and work and serve together with them. You can't be a lone wolf when it comes to your Christianity. So if you don't have a home congregation, go out and find one. If you're actively looking right now for a place and you happen to be within driving distance of the Elkhart East Building, please come check us out and see whether or not we might fulfill your expectations as a church home. We are going to open our Bibles to Exodus chapter number 32 today. I am going to read again from the very beginning of the chapter, just to get the context full. We know that Moses has been up on Mount Sinai talking with God, getting plans for the tabernacle, but also going over some of the rules and regulations in fine detail that he's going to need for the people when they go into the Promised Land. And he is starting to wrap all of that up. When we come to the 39th day, the people down below have given up on Moses. It says in chapter 32, verse 1, when the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said, get up, make us Elohim, make us gods who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what happened. We don't know what's become of him. So the leadership representation here seems to have said, we need to call it quits on waiting for Moses to come back. He must be dead. What we need, Aaron, is for you to act as our religious leader. You need to make us a representation of the God who brought us up out of Egypt. And Aaron, as I complained last session, did not take a stand against this false suggestion. He caves. He complies. And then he tries to bring two worlds together, the world of idolatry and the world of belief in the one true God. So verse 2 says, so Aaron said to them, you take off the rings of gold that are in the ears of your wives, your sons, your daughters, bring them to me. So all the people took off the rings of gold that were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made a golden calf. So as I explained yesterday, the calf was a representation of the creator God of Memphis, a major city of Egypt, not very far from where the Israelites had lived for the past 430 years. And so Aaron tries to equate this calf with the Creator God who brought them out of Egypt. And the people are on board with that syncretism. When they saw this gigantic, and I don't know if it was scale to an actual life size of a bull. He had a lot of gold to work with. If you think about 600,000 plus men and then all their wives and their kids that have been wearing these earrings, even if they gave one bit of gold, that's a lot of gold. And so it may have been supersized. As soon as they see this familiar image of the Apis bull, the representation of Ptah, P P-T-A-H, the creator god of Memphis. It says, they responded, oh, these are your gods. These are your Elohim, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation, said, tomorrow shall be a feast to he who is. And that verse makes it absolutely plain that they think that they're going to be worshiping God by worshiping this golden calf. So they rose up early the next day, which chronologically is the first day of a new month. It's the first day of the fifth month. It's also the, I think it's the 40th day. It's the 41st day, I guess, for Moses getting up and coming down from him being up on the mountain. So they rose up early the next day. They offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, all typical things of worship. And then the people sat down to eat and drink afterwards, because that's a fellowship meal. That's quite common as well in worship. And then they rose up to play, which I told you more than likely has a sexual element to it in this context. It probably represents how they associated the pagan rituals of having sexual activity in honor of the gods and the goddesses. This is all bad, very bad. Then we shift our attention back up to the top of Mount Sinai on the morning of the first of the fifth month. He who is said to Moses, go down, for your people, which I have to smile a little bit about that, because all of us have seen that happen, where a parent says to the other parent, your son or your daughter did something, and that's to put emphasis on, you need to take care of this, right? And so that's what Moses, what God does with Moses. God says, go down, your people, whom you brought up out of the land of Egypt, meaning you're responsible for them, you're supposed to be their leader. They have corrupted themselves. They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them. And that's true. They have violated the first commandment because they're actually worshiping Ptah, the creator god of the city of Memphis. They've violated the second commandment where they've made an idol of a god and bowed down to it. They are violating the third commandment because they are using God's name in a vain way by equating him with this idol in the image of Ptah. They've also violated other of the commandments because more than likely they're playing around sexually with people other than their wives or their betrothed ones. And so it is a mess, an absolute mess. They've made for themselves a golden calf. They've worshipped it. They've sacrificed to it. And they've said, these are your gods, your Elohim, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And he who has said to Moses, I have seen this people. Basically, I have watched these people for the last, you know, eternity. But in particular, during the last 100 days or so, because it's now been about that long since they left Egypt. It is a stiff-necked people, which is a way of saying they are stubborn. They don't like to change their ways. They've spent 430 years in Egypt, and over that time, the Israelis, many of them, have adopted a pagan mindset. They may have still kept some of the ideas of tradition from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. They may have talked about this God Most High of the Promised Land, but they have folded in all sorts of other things as well. And now that they are free of Egypt and all its influences, it is clear that Egypt is still in them. And that's what God is talking about. And then he makes this offer to Moses. And it is an offer to highlight the need that Moses has to act as intercessor on behalf of the people. Now, an intercessor represents both sides. So Moses is representing God to the people, but he's also representing the people to God. It's a two-way street for Moses. He has to do both jobs, or he's not really an intercessor. And so God gives him something to exercise that intercessory aspect on behalf of the people. Now, therefore, let me alone, or if you'll leave me alone, my wrath will burn hot against them, and I'm going to consume them in order that I may make a great nation of you. So he suggests to Moses, you know what, if you'll just get out of the way, I can wipe this bunch out, and we'll just start with you and your family, and we'll start making a new way of people that will go and live in the promised land. Now, of course, God already knows how he's going to react, but Moses needs to know himself how he will react in that circumstance when God offers him the opportunity to blow these people off and just start fresh with him and his family. And his heart tells him, no, that would not be right because it would violate your promises, God. And see, that is important. Do not ever get the idea that Moses is telling God anything here that God doesn't know. Don't imagine that Moses is changing God's mind here. Moses is actually solidifying his position as intercessor. Because you remember, when all this story started with Moses back in Midian, he didn't want the job. He repeatedly tried to wiggle out of it. But now, from what we're about to read, it is clear that he's embraced it and that it is important to him that this is seen to its prophetic end. So verse 11, Moses implored he who is his God and said, oh, he who is, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you've brought up out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians get to say, with evil intent did he bring them out to kill them in the mountains and to consume them from the face of the earth? So Moses begins trying to convince God. God doesn't need convinced. Again, this is all for the sake of Moses here. Understand that. But Moses feels the need to say, God, the Egyptians will say that you were not very godly if you do this. And so he makes the request, turn from your burning anger, relent from this disaster against your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and all the land that I have promised I will give to your offspring, and they shall inherit it forever. So now Moses is echoing back to God, God's promises. But God, you can't just blow them off. You can't blow them up, because you made the promise to Abraham and then to Isaac and then to Jacob, who becomes Israel, the name by which all these people are called. You promised to all of them that they were going to be a huge group and that they were going to get to inherit the promised land. You have to keep your promises, God. And of course, God always keeps his promises. And God always intended to keep his promise. But now Moses is all the more invested in acting as intercessor between God and the people and people and God. And so he who is relented, it's actually the word that we've talked about before, about the heavy sigh. And it's got the idea of an exasperated sigh. And so God basically says, all right, Moses, that's what we'll do. We'll continue down this path. But it's basically God letting Moses understand, you chose to do what you're doing. So he who is relented from the disaster that he had spoken of bringing on his people. And now the invested Moses has to go and deal with his disobedient kids, because Moses is now acting like a father figure. And boy, oh boy, have the kids been brats. He only went away for 40 days, and they went crazy. So verse 15, Moses turned. He went down the mountain with the two tablets of the testimony in his hand. Remember, we read about those at the end of chapter 31, that God had written on them the text of the Ten Commandments from Exodus chapter 20 with his own finger. So this is a signature piece of writing by God. And so Moses takes those two tablets of the testimony in his hand, tablets that were written on both sides, on the front and on the back they were written. The tablets were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God engraved on the tablets. And you remember last session I talked about how through time, at least in some of the documents that we have, people have tried to copy the original letter form from the Ten Commandments section whenever they write the name of He Who Is. And so here is an emphasis on the idea that this is the handwriting of God. Verse 17, now when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, you might have forgotten, Joshua went up at least partway with Moses onto Mount Sinai. And so he's been camped out here on a lower level of the mountain this whole 40-day period. And this morning, when he woke up and maybe cooked his breakfast or whatever it was he did, he started hearing all that stuff going on with the worship of the golden calf down below on the flatlands. So when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, Moses, there's the noise of war in the camp. Now, the other thing that we know about Joshua is that he is the military commander that serves for Moses. I suppose in some respects, he's like Moses' aide-de-camp. He's the guy that is Moses' right-hand man. He's actually Moses' selected, hand-picked person to take over eventually. And we'll see that, but that's going to be 40 years from now. So he's like, it sounds like there's a war going on there. I think maybe they've been attacked again. We need to get down there. That's what his idea is. But Moses said back to him, verse 18, it's not the sound of shouting for victory or the sound of a cry of defeat. It's the sound of singing that I hear. So he hears them partying, and he hears them correctly because they are partying. They are partying as if they're pagans. And so together, Moses and Joshua go down all the way to the camp. As soon as he came near the camp and he saw the calf and the dancing, so as he comes down below the level of where God's glory cloud was, or maybe he came around a bend in the path, he looks at the camp, and what does he see? He sees a gigantic golden calf, an Apis bull. Now, he would have been familiar with it, and he knows what it is. It's an idol. There's just no two ways about it. So as soon as he came near the camp, and he saw the calf, and he saw the dancing that's going on, Now, some of that can be just worship dancing, line dancing. Don't think line dancing like happens at weddings nowadays. Think more of the folk dancing where people are grabbing a hold of hands and going through the encampment. But this dancing may have also, as I've already suggested, have some sexual elements to it because they've been playing. So he sees all of this going on. Moses' anger burned hot. He is furious. And he threw the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. Now, there's been a lot of debate as to exactly why Moses did this. Is he just having a fit and in his fit of anger breaks these things? Or, and this is the one I gravitate toward, in his anger, does he look at the things that these guys have been breaking that are right there in his two hands? Because they violated the first three for sure. Does he look at these written in the handwriting of God and say, these guys are not worthy of receiving something this holy? And he shatters it as a symbol of the fact that they had broken these commandments and they were not worthy of being in possession of God's handwriting. And I think that's the more likely explanation as to why he does this. I think it's perfectly on purpose. We know for sure the thing that he does in verse 20, he does on purpose. Now, it happens later. We'll get to the place where it happens. But this is what it says. He took the calf that they'd made. He burned it with fire, which makes it soft because it's gold. And then he ground it to powder and he scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. So he basically annihilates their idol, but tells them that they're going to have to drink into their bodies the gold that they had used in making this idol. So he scatters this gold dust that he produces on that stream that's coming from Mount Sinai that God has provided miraculously for them. And so they'll be drinking this gold dust-infused water for a while. Now, verse 21. This is what happened as soon as Moses got close to Aaron. Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you brought such a great sin upon them?" So he is exasperated. He is shocked. He is in disbelief that his brother, who's about 3 years older than him, who he's been working with for months, representing he who is to the people, doing miracles. He cannot believe that this man standing in front of him caved whenever these people wanted to violate the first three commandments of the Ten Commandments. Now, Aaron's response, and this is the one I kind of hinted at before, that it's just shocking. Aaron said, "Let not the anger of my Lord burn hot." Now, that's intriguing because, as I already said, Aaron is 3 years older than Moses. So from that standard, Moses would normally refer to Aaron as my Lord. That's just the protocol of the time period. But Aaron acknowledges that Moses is senior to him because Moses has direct communication with God that Aaron does not get. And therefore he calls him my Lord. So, "Let not the anger of my Lord burn hot. You know the people, that they're set on evil." A little bit of blame shifting there. a little bit of I'm the victim in this, Moses. For they said to me, make us Elohim that who should go before us. As for this man, the Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what's become of him. So I said to them, let any of you who have gold take it off. So they gave it to me. And here it comes, folks. Believe it or not, this is what he said. I threw it into the fire, and out came this calf. So he tries to give some sort of supernatural explanation as to why he was a participant in this. And I don't know what happened at that point. I picture, now this is just my imagination, folks. Maybe yours is different. I picture Moses staring into the face of his brother for a few seconds after hearing him say that, and then just turning around and walking away without saying another word to him. Because that's kind of what we do when somebody tells us something that we just can't hardly believe the words came out of their mouth. That certainly they are smarter, more plugged in than that, and yet that's what they said. And it's just unbelievable. And so there's nothing to be said at that moment because it's just beyond belief. And so that's where we're going to kind of leave our story today, is Moses being shocked that Aaron would make the claim that what he did was understandable for the circumstances. When we come back next session, we are going to see how Moses stops the partying that is still going on at this juncture.